I'm Christopher Lydon, confronting our worst fears of technology. Is Google making us stupid, for example? Are remote-controlled drones, or in different ways, synthetic drugs undermining our humanity? Our guest is the technophile who's thought it all through, the brilliant ghost inside the Wired magazine machine, Kevin Kelly. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Kevin Kelly, welcome, and thank you for the learned, long view in this book of yours, What Technology Wants. But what about what we want? What about what people say they're afraid of? Are cell phones causing brain tumors? Is Facebook a form of autism? Is the biosphere doomed already by just the carbon that our machines spew into the upper air? Are we doomed by our own collective inability so far to break our fossil fuel and our techno addictions? Is the Steve Jobs product line another sort of addiction by now? Those were the kinds of questions I brought to your book, Kevin Kelly. And then your book changed the subject on the way to changing my mind. But would you begin with your short course on just what technology is, organic technology, technology that's not really stuff at all?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me into this conversation. I came to this problem about technology through my own experience growing up being somewhat skeptical of the kind of intensity that our technological lives were taking. I was a little bit of a hippie in the late 60s and 70s and had that kind of enculturated skepticism about machines and the inhumanity of the technological sphere.
I knew you worked with the Whole Earth Catalog, but I'd forgotten if I ever knew, Kevin, that you're a sort of low-tech guy, basically.
Yeah, I did the dropout thing. I read the Whole Earth Catalog and believed it wholeheartedly. Dropped out of college, went to Asia, roamed the back parts of the most remote areas of Asia where there was very little material goods, and saw that people could be content and happy. And so that kind of fed into my fantasy that we didn't need very much in our lives to be content and happy. I came back and I rode a bicycle across the U.S. and encountered the Amish, whom I fell in love with as an examples of people who seem to have a very sane attitude toward technology. At the same time that was going on, there was a dawning awareness among many people that there's a large system at work. There's the idea of systems understandings, of cybernetics and the ecology and ecosystems and life as a system. And so there was some attraction that I had to computers, that there was a kind of an integrity to these very large computer systems that might in some ways teach us about nature. I think, you know, maybe I would still be a kind of technologically skeptical person, but what changed this all was my encounter in the early 80s with the very first computer networks. Like a lot of people who had a computer, it was kind of maddening. They were very dumb, very elementary, not very friendly, required a lot of esoteric knowledge to even get the most elementary usefulness out of them. But something happened when you plugged those things together into the, onto the phone system. And when that happened in the, and we would spend time online, as we were calling it at that time, it was all... Nothing was visual. It was just little green letters that would flicker across your screen. Something awakened in me to the beauty of technology because there was suddenly this virtual place. Things were happening there. Even with this primitive technology, people were connecting in ways that seemed to me almost like a neighborly, community, wholesome, social way. And it was very clear from the very beginning, with the most primitive of these bulletin boards, that there was something powerful unleashed. And I think that was the beginning in my own mind of a reevaluation of what this technological stuff was.
You were probably 10 years ahead of me, but I know that sort of dawning excitement of a new social order. For me, the technology and the business organization had almost no interest, but the idea of a different points of connection was huge. You speak of a moment when you saw through technology's disguise as material and began to see it as action. Explain those words.
Well, I think anybody who had any kind of prolonged contact with the digital realm of computers, and including sort of our own education in the mechanics of life, is understanding that it was actually a DNA code, was part of a kind of a long-term shift to understanding that the basis of much of what we find interesting in the world, like life and even our own minds to some extent, is all based on information. And information is probably the most intangible thing that we actually have any experience with. And so there was this emergence of a general trend. As the world became more materially developed, we were making more and more new substances and more hardware and in filling our cities and our suburbs with material things, that underneath all this pulsed information, that the information was sort of like the way in which you controlled it and maybe even made it. And more importantly, it seemed to be the thing that animated all these good things. And so there was a sense that the most powerful thing at work was information, and we were in the information age. And this is a very intangible quality, and yet here it was underpinning the economy. And so maybe even more than an economy, it seemed to be underpinning the very nature of the stuff that we were making. And so this idea that the same thing that was the essential element of life may also be the essential element of computers and computer life and digital life, there was this sort of a dawning that, hey, our entire material world is built upon the immaterial. When you take that view, and which is the view I adopted, you can kind of extend it and say that there is this sort of march of increasingly complex information, and that arrow of increasingly complicated information is actually the thing that is, cursing through history, that we start off very simple and we increase the complexity of things, and that behind everything, like our minds and the life, not just our lives, but the life of all the species on the planet and the life of the internet and all these things are all based on this immaterial substance called information, it tends to kind of form a uniform theology, I guess you might call it. And I posit something, I call it the technium. And what that is the kind of the intelligence of all the machines, and it includes human intelligence and human effort, but also the web of interrelated machines and inventions and gadgets and technology that we have spanning the planet, and that thing together with us is something whole. It's an integrated, lifelike system, and it's not, I don't believe, conscious yet, But it doesn't have to be conscious to actually have an effect on us.
Yeah, you write about it not as a noun, but as a verb, a force, a spirit. But I'm not yet clear, Kevin, is this something that dawned in your mind at a certain moment, or do you think there was a moment in history when this thing, this collective invention of humanity, our machines, took on its own self-propelling momentum, its own life?
I see these things, these qualities of life, quality of mind, as a continuum. In other words, I think there, you know, we ourselves have a great difficulty right now deciding whether a virus is alive or not. And that's because even life itself is not a, it's not binary. It's not like there or not there. It's there in degrees, and there's a little bit more of it as you go along. And actually, I believe that like a mammal has more life than a bacterium. So it's a continuum. It's not binary. And the same thing with autonomy. Autonomy is a continuum. It's not that you either are autonomous or not. Even humans are not 100% autonomous. When we're born as babies, we need other beings around us to keep us alive. And so the beginning of the technium autonomy it's mild right now. It has a measure of autonomy. It's not fully autonomous, but there is some element of autonomy in it, which means that there's some way that this whole system, all the wires in the world, all the factories, all the roads, all the interconnected inventions that we have, there is some way in which all together they exert their own leaning. And we see this every large complex system that we make internally has some inherent leaning or urge, and that is true of the technium as a whole.
Kevin Kelly, we've got to get to this question of destructiveness and the dark side, as you write. You're not shy about seeing the dark side, but you also believe that the evolution of technology, which has its own rules, somewhat different from the rules that govern plants and animals, the direction is progressive. It's getting better. And all of these things are profoundly controversial. First of all, just describe the process by which you believe the whole technological system evolves. And then let's get to the price we're paying for it. Some people would say, you know, it's already too late to find any good news here.
I think that every new technology that we invent creates new problems. And we have to be very honest about the fact that most of the problems in the world today are technogenic, that they're actually generated by technology to solve earlier problems. And as we look forward to more technology, we can expect fully to be even more problems. What that means, I think, is that we can't escape the, as you would call it, the dark side, except in one way, which I think the solution to the problems of technology is not to have less technology, but actually to have more technology. And some people would say, well, that means that it's just neutral. Technology is neutral because you have as many problems as solutions, and therefore it kind of washes out. But I think that the very fact that we have a choice that we didn't have before. We have every technology makes a new choice between the problems that it creates and the solutions, that choice itself is a good that tips the balance in favor of the good overall.
You're talking about choice, and yet there's a big thrust in the book, Kevin, that we don't have a choice about this technology. You say at one point, it really struck me, that if we had to give up our fundamental technologies, you know, starting with rocks to bang beetles with, the human species wouldn't last but a month or two. That we are now symbiotic with our technology, that we couldn't live without it. I think that's the way a lot of people feel, you know, when they go to the computer store or even when they read these headlines about our weapon systems, that it's too late to choose almost anything.
I think in the largest forms, the technological progression is inevitable. We don't have a choice about whether there's an internet. We do have a choice about what kind of internet we are going to make. The reason why we don't have a choice is because it is very clear from history and from the study of technology that, you know, inventions or every invention is simultaneously occurring. Whatever invention you can think of, from the light bulb to the bicycle to nuclear rockets to anything, they're all discovered simultaneously.
I love that passage in your book, starting with Darwin. If he hadn't invented and got famous for evolution, Alfred Russel Wallace would have. He had the same idea at the same moment. That idea was ripe for the picking. And I was struck also that, you know, this movie, The Social Network, turns entirely on the point that many people had the Facebook idea at exactly the same time. But I don't know what to make of that point, though.
Well, what the point is that on the if you rerun the tape of life and technology and play it again, the same basic general outlines of technology will occur. And they're inevitable. They're just built into the very fabric of physical matter and energy. But the kind, the what I call the expression of that, you know, Facebook, let's say, who governs it, who runs it, whether it's for profit, is it nonprofit, is it primarily open, is the default closed, is it transparent, or is it open? All those things are not inevitable and are our choices. And so we have the analogy I kind of use is your human development is inevitable, is predetermined. You don't have any choice about whether you're going to be a teenager. You do have some choice about what kind of teenager you can be. And so, you know, we have a certain amount of stuff that's determined by our genes, but within that, we still have plenty of room to make choices. And so in the long form, the larger outlines of technology are predetermined. They're inevitable. But that still gives us tremendous opportunity to choose within that. And those choices are actually the things that we pay a lot of attention to and that do determine the tenor and the sort of atmosphere of the technologies around it. For instance, do we weaponize them? We don't have to do that. And those are not inevitable. Those jobs for the technologies are not inevitable. We can point them away from that if we want to.
So, Kevin Kelly, stand back and give me your estimate of the real direction, some of it chosen, some of it not, of technology in 2010. I'm thinking 10-10-10, October 10th, 2010, just passed, in which Bill McKibben and the people around the world of 350.org sort of made this desperate plea for common people to take the problem of the world's destruction out of the hands of politicians. But anyway, at this emergency moment, when some people think it's already hopeless, what do you take to be the real direction of things?
Well, in my study of technology as an outgrowth of life, and so what I propose is that the dynamics that govern the technological system, the technium, are really extensions, if not even accelerations, of evolutionary life. That when we look at the technological system or the technological complex that we have made, that its behavior is really very much like other evolutionary living systems. And that I call it the seventh kingdom of life after the six kingdoms. They're, you know, from the animal kingdom, we've produced this other kingdom of life, of artificial synthetic creatures in the system, and that therefore a lot of the behavior of technology as a whole is really an extension of living systems as a whole. And in my investigation of what those general principles of life are, is that we are moving over 4 billion years towards increasing complexity, increasing diversity, increasing specialization, increasing energy efficiency, increasing structure, increasing sentience, increasing beauty, increasing freedom and choices. And so there is a general direction to life and evolution in the universe.
Give an example in this polluted world of where you see beauty gaining.
I would say that I find the internet beautiful. That there is a, you know, this sort of ecology, the richness and the deepness and the way in which the thing serves us and has its own depth, I find a type of beauty.
Balance that against the destruction of wilderness, the species crash, the slum poverty, all kinds of things, Kevin, that we think of as the direct consequences of technology and are profoundly ugly and disquieting.
Sure. A lot of people would say they find nature beautiful, but you go to the moment when a lion is tearing into a little baby deer and you have to turn your head. Is that beautiful? I mean, so obviously even within nature, there are moments or episodes when we're repulsed.
Now, that is shocking and gruesome and maybe beautiful all at the same time. But the disappearance of the tiger in India, the extinction of that incredible signature animal, even in human consciousness, is despicable and scary.
Well, again, there is an aspect of nature that is ugly. And we'd have to say that the loss of the dinosaurs was an ugly event.
Yep.
Okay? So nature is perfectly capable of producing its own ugliness. And I think that's just inherent in any very large system. And so I think it's inherent that there is some ugliness in the technological system.
Struck me as I read the book that you're the Robert Wright of technology. Robert Wright thinks evolution has a direction and it's good. It may even look and sound like religious notions of intention and God's own promotion and development of his species. Is that a fair way to describe your or to compare your notion of the progress in technological evolution?
I think, like Robert, I do see it as a continuum. I do see technological progress as an extension and acceleration of the progressive nature of evolution. And I think, you know, right now the idea that evolution is progressive is a minority view. It was completely out of fashion a number of years ago, mostly because the evolutionary biologists were arguing there was no evidence for it. But recently, mostly driven by people who had some familiarity with computational systems, there's been a reevaluation and a mounting evidence that, in fact, there is a direction to natural evolution, that there is a movement over time towards complexity and diversity and the things that I listed earlier. And so in that way, I would say yes. The idea of progress as a kind of cosmic trajectory, a cosmic arc through time in the universe, and that we are in the midst of something that we're headed towards and beyond us. And in a certain sense, the way I would put it is that technology has its roots in the Big Bang, that it kind of preceded us and will outlast us, that we, humanity, are just a process on the way to something much bigger than us.
And yet there's still all of this dark side stuff even in your book and in the history you recount. You make a significant point that the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, was right. And he was willing to murder people recklessly if he could drive a stake through technology's heart. In what sense was Ted Kaczynski right?
Well, first of all, I just want to make it very clear that I don't think he was right in terms of his actions. I think, you know, he was a serial murderer, but he was right in he saw that technology was not just a bunch of independent wires and gadgets, that it formed a whole and that it had its own agenda. Now, he believed that the agenda of technology was to thwart and strangle individual freedom. I argue that, in fact, the freedom that the Unabomber, that Ted Kaczynski himself had in his little shack, was an illusion. We know just from history that millions of people a year flee from shacks like his in the mountains of their respective countries and head towards the cities where they live in slums that seem to be worse than the little shack they left. But they're coming to the city because they are there for the increased choices and options. That's what technology brings us. That's what this system that Ted Kaczynski saw as a whole system, that's what it gives us. It gives us increasing choices and options, and we will always gravitate towards those.
That's a really arguable, interesting but arguable proposition that people leave villages for the city in freedom, or that they find a better life in Mumbai or Harlem, coming from the deep south in the 30s and 40s, for that matter. I mean, what makes you so sure that that's good news for anybody?
Right. So there's the question can be stated, are people pushed into cities or are they pulled into them? Are they basically forced out of their village homes because of, you know, whatever it is?
Right. I mean, are they driven by starvation, or in the case of the American South and the Great Migration that we've been talking about, driven by threats of lynching and the most abject kind of oppression?
Right. I think that in most cases, overall, I mean, with many exceptions, that the driver is the attraction of betterment, that people calculated that you had more choices and opportunities in the city for whatever reason.
No, you might leave very reluctantly because the corn market or whatever it is you're growing has been destroyed by imports or something.
Right. And so you have at that moment is where do you have more possibilities? Is it in the city or is it in I mean the problem with the village life was that it was very unstable. It was dependent upon the weather. You have a couple of years of drought and you were on the edge of survival. It didn't take very much. And so they moved to the city because overall the city is much more resilient to these kinds of perturbations. And so I think there is a way in which a new technology can decrease choices in certain areas, but overall, people move towards new and improved possibilities.
Interesting. Kevin Kelly, in your understanding of how technology evolves, what are the checks on it? And particularly the human checks on, you know, the ultimate weapon or the ultimate numbing drug or poisons or chemical fertilizers that may be destroying soil or whatever. In different cases, what stops it?
First of all, I think we ourselves, you and I talking right now, are in large part an invention of our own minds, that we have made ourselves. We were the first domesticated animal, that we invented language, and language transformed ourselves, and our bodies actually have, instead of slowing down, they're actually speeding up. They're actually, our biological evolution continues to speed up because of technology. But at the same time, of course, while we are the parents of what we make, we are also the children of it. We are both the masters and the slave of technology. And I think we always have that kind of duality, that tension between the fact that we serve technology and technology serves us. And that tension will never go away. And the question you're asking is, well, what's preventing it, technology, from just taking over? And I think part of the answer is that we are always going to be part of it. That it's not, when I talk about the autonomy of the technium, we have to remember that we will always be part of that. The technium includes us. And so we are there. I think what's happening is that we were going to transform ourselves. We are not the people who walked out of Africa, and we will not be the same people that we are today in another 20, 30, 100 years. And so we are going to become something different.
I'm also wondering, Kevin, how you respond to the everyday things that make people think technology is out of control. For example, the market meltdown, all the computerized trading that collapsed in 2007, 2008, or for that matter, you know, the BP disaster in the Gulf. Our machines are working against us now, including the fantasies that they put in our heads of, you know, sucking oil out of the earth a mile or more underwater.
Sure. I guess I view these things as kind of illnesses. I mean, it's sort of like when you have a very complex system, there are going to be ways that it can have disease, the ways it can get sick. And so these are sicknesses. And there is no escape from having these things occurring. I think the remedy is sort of what we're doing is to make a system more and more interrelatedly complex that becomes more resilient to the fatal disease. You know, we're going to have these accidents and we're going to have these this destruction. But as long as we create more than we destroy, even if it's just a few percent a year, that's progress.
Kevin Kelly, I'm fascinated with your fascination with the Amish farmers in Pennsylvania, but lots of other places. Horse plow farmers, religiously inspired, experiencing a boom, and in some fashion, you make an example of them. They're not people without technology, obviously, but they seem to have decided they'll stay 50 years behind the curve.
The thing about that surprised me about the Amish is that they're not Luddites. They're not against technology at all. They're actually hackers. They love to play with the rules. And it took me a long time to understand that while their separation from the technological realm is driven by kind of a religious belief, their stance on technology is really a lifestyle choice. It's something that they are very aware of. They're very aware of technology outside, and they choose this because they find it practically, usefully, enables them to optimize what they're trying to optimize. So, this is interesting because actually I think what technology wants to optimize and what I believe we are optimizing is choices. What the Amish are optimizing is actually leisure and a kind of fixed idea of human nature. Mm-hmm. So they actually do have more leisure and comfort and satisfaction from their lives than I think the average modern person does. But the cost of that is that they don't have many choices. If you're a girl, your destiny is very clear. You're a housewife producing a lot of children. If you're a guy, you can be either a farmer or you can be a tradesman, you know, working in a shop. You can't be a mathematician. Mm. You can't be a classical musician. You can't be an artist. So the cost of surrendering their choices to maximize comfort and leisure and maybe a sense of wholeness, they're willing to do that. And, you know, I admire them for that choice.
They also have standards of community welfare and community preservation that don't apply to Americans or the rest of us in general.
Yeah, and that's how they have this wholeness and this leisure is in fact because they – I don't want to say they're self-reliant because that also is an illusion, but they're very community-oriented. And so when they look at a new technology, they have two questions, really, that they ask about any new technology. One is, does it bring together the family? Can we use this technology working at home? Because most of the Amish have farms and they're home for every meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, or they work in a shop, and ideally that shop's in their backyard. And so they're always asking the question, will this technology allow me to, you know, work in the backyard and stay at home and emphasize the family? And two, does it bring our community together? So the reason why they have horse and buggy is not because they really like horses and buggies, and it's because they found that with a horse and buggy, they had to stay in the community on Sundays. They had to shop at somewhere that was within 15 miles. That when they had the car, they would go out of the community. So it was not strengthening their communities. And that's the criteria that they use for selecting technology. So then it's interesting because when cell phone comes along, the question was, does this help families and communities? And they're actually saying, some of the churches are saying yes to cell phones.
But in your own perspective, by the end of this book, Kevin Kelly, there is a real religious impulse or understanding running through the whole thing. You even quote our friend Ray Kurzweil of the Kurzweil Piano, of the talking book, and now of much more advanced brain science. He calls himself an atheist, but he says that the evolution of technology is moving inexorably toward a conception of God, although it'll never quite get there. Bring God into your understanding of how this whole vast mechanism, organism, is advancing.
What Ray is saying, just as a starting point, is that if you try to make a definition of God, that you get something that sort of has, you know, it's sort of infinitely complex, infinitely knowledgeable, infinite mind, infinite diversity, infinite holism, all wrapped up into this very paradoxical entity. And he says that, and I agree with him, that that is sort of the direction in which, you know, the evolution of life and mind and technology is headed towards, that it's moving in all those ways to increase the things that we would describe as the attributes of God. And so I think that it's fair to talk about the spiritual dimension of technology, because if we take this sort of very liberal definition of God as a process that is increasing, or as the destination of this increase, then it kind of reveals a theological direction to the universe, which is that it's started out kind of plain and is moving towards something that is, that there's a direction, and it's moving towards something that we would use the words godlike in describing. Mm. And one of the aspects of these systems that I talked about, life and mind, that there's a kind of an auto-generative aspect of it. The miracle about DNA is that not only can it produce all these different forms of life, you know, 1.7 million different species alive today, and, you know, maybe 10 or 100 million over the course of life's 4 billion years. The most remarkable thing about this molecule is not all the life that it makes, but the fact that it made itself, that it self-assembled. And that auto-generation where you have something that it can make something more complicated than itself is sort of the thing that we're looking at right now. Are our minds, the human minds, capable of making a mind more complicated than itself?
This has intrigued me since the beginning of the internet, including the God connection. The internet does meet almost all those little definitions of God you heard in third grade. I mean, he's and it are everywhere and nowhere. They know everything. They remember everything. They see everything. They contain everything, etc. You can play it out. But also, St. Augustine defined God in one passage as a circle whose center is everywhere, whose circumference is nowhere. But there are all these temptations to see correspondences here. What do we do with them in the end? What do you do with them, Kevin Kelly?
You know, I happen to think that even God himself or itself is in the process of change. The God itself is not a thing or an artifact, but is a process in the making. I think our jobs on earth is actually to surprise God. I see what humans are about, what technology is about, is technology is a way of evolution to make things that biology could not. So there are certain forms and certain types of minds in the universe that are possible that biology in the wet tissue form could not make. And so it makes a mind, and then the mind itself can make new kinds of minds that biology cannot make. And what we're trying to do is to make as many different kinds of minds and sentience as possible, a billion different kinds of minds. And it will require all those different kinds of minds to really apprehend the full mystery of the universe.
So funny, Kevin Kelly. A lot of your readers think of you as a gadget freak, and here you are, a philosopher, a theologian. I'm wondering, is there a name for the religious outlook that you've just described?
It's called, I'm a possibilian. This is David Eagleman's term. A possibilian, I believe that in his terms, we know too much to kind of believe in the old version of God as a guy in a long white beard, or even as the hacker God. But we're also too ignorant of the world to believe that we know anything about it. And so I believe that what we are about and we're moving towards and what we need to entertain are possibilities. The possibilities that we're wrong, the possibilities that we're moving towards, and the possibilities of that we're creating with technology. So I'm a possibilian.
And at the end of your book, you describe this whole process of technological evolution as an infinite game worth playing. What does that tell you?
There are two kinds of games in the world. There's games where there's winners and losers, and that's most of the games we play, you know, from computer games to backgammon to Monopoly to sports games. Infinite games are a different set of games, and here the point of the game is to not win or lose, but to extend the game, to extend the playing of it, to make it last as long as possible, to bring as many people in as players, and to keep going. And there, the only way to keep going is you have to keep changing the rules. So it becomes the art of changing rules to keep the game going. And when we look at evolution and we look at technological development and we look at things that we do with our minds, they're really all about the infinite games, about kind of keeping the thing going, changing the rules as we go along. And the great surprise about these infinite games is really that there's only one infinite game. It's all the same game. And what we're trying to do is kind of keep the game going, to explore as many different possibilities as possible. You know, what I say evolution is about evolving all the different ways to evolve, you know, to explore all the ways to explore, to invent all the ways to invent, to search all the ways to search, to learn all the ways to learn. That's really what the long-term trend's about.
Kevin Kelly, you're a game worth playing. I've so enjoyed getting to know you better, and you taught me a lot, both in your book and in this conversation. Can't thank you enough.
It's been my pleasure. I really appreciate your interest, and I'm really glad that you asked these great questions.
Kevin Kelly, thank you. We'll do it again.
Okay, thanks.
Ben Mandelkern and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.